Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today we examine the looming threat of North Korea.
The North Koreans have miniaturized a nuclear weapon which they can put atop a ballistic missile and then target the United States. That's pretty serious.
We'll look at the potential response.
There are many voices in the Congress who I'm connected to who want to do some kind of action.
And how that could play out.
This would surely get messy. This is what Milley, the Army Chief, called potential megacity combat, which we've never seen before.
Later, the media reaction to the firing at Google.
Newsrooms are over-concerned about diversity because they don't have it.
And one college president fights political correctness on campus.
We can't be satisfied with coddling and cuddling and comfort and safety. Education is more than that. It's bigger and better than that.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. What started out as one of the slowest news week in the Trump era exploded into one of the hottest as North Korea once again lobbed ominous threats at the United States. It began with news that this rogue nation had developed a small nuclear weapon capable of riding atop an intercontinental ballistic missile. And just that quickly, the distant threat is no longer so distant. There's a great deal of speculation as to exactly how far along North Korea is in their efforts to have a deployable nuclear weapon capable of reaching the United States. But the threat is clearly much closer today than imagined even a month ago. To many, it feels like it's at our doorstep, and it's our move. On Tuesday, President Trump reacted.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
North Korea responded with a direct threat against the U.S. air base in Guam. The next morning, I spoke with Congressman Mike Gallagher, a veteran of the Marine Corps and a member of the House Armed Services Committee. Now, I've got a lot of friends in the military and retired, and they tell me we need at least three aircraft carriers over there. We would need two Ohio-class submarines full of Tomahawks. We would need Aegis defense shield. We would need look for the evacuation of military dependents. Look for a number. He doesn't think we're close. What do you think?
Listen, I visited U.S. Forces Korea under the able command of General Vincent Brooks last month. I have no doubt that they would be ready to fight tonight if necessary, in addition to the 30,000 troops we have in Korea, which is the largest concentration of American forces on the Asian mainland. We would surge a lot of the naval assets to the region. I like what Jerry Hendricks said. In gaming out a potential conflict at the outset of it, we would find every North Korean ship at sea and destroy it. Probably hit it with Tomahawks. Our allies also bring to this fight enormous capability. The South Korean military is highly capable with 650,000 troops and another 3 million in reserve. The Japanese have also made significant investments in their self-defense troops. We have thousands of Marines that are stationed in Okinawa who would be ready to do an amphibious landing, which would be the first amphibious landing since the Korean conflict. So while it would not be easy, while it would be messy, and ultimately you confront the thorny problem of the thousands of artillery pieces that are dug into Kaesong Heights that can range Seoul, which is 35 miles from the DMZ, that's really the aspect of this that I can't wrap my head around, because there's no missile defense system that has been designed that can fully protect the 10 million people that are in Seoul proper or the 26 million people that are in the greater metropolitan area. This is the second largest metropolitan area in the world. North Korea also has 5,000 tons of chemical weapons, so this would surely get messy. This is what Milley called, the Army Chief called, potential megacity combat, which we've never seen before. So on the one hand, I'm quite confident in our own capability and our ability to surge more assets and bring our allies' assets to bear on this fight. And the South Koreans also do a good job of operating in an interdependent way with us. Their systems talk to ours. But you still cannot protect completely against the missile threat, particularly as it pertains to Seoul. So this is a very dangerous situation, a very dangerous time, and it's going to require resolve. And I, for one, am glad, in particular listening to your interview with H.R. McMaster, that we have guys like him in charge. And I just would say to all the Twitter trolls and the lemmings who are buying this Russian influence operation against McMaster, it's time to stop it. I mean, this man is a patriot. He brings an enormous wealth of experience to this. And in times of crisis, this is precisely the person that we want advising the president. I served under H.R. McMaster for a year, so obviously I'm biased, but I can tell you from my firsthand experience, He's a man of exceptional courage and commitment to American interests.
That same morning, I turned to Robert Costa, reporter for The Washington Post, a man well-connected in D.C. I'm focused more on what a war on North Korea's peninsula and South Korea's peninsula might mean. But what does your reporting tell you about imminence of conflict, if any?
Well, the rhetoric has escalated, but behind the scenes, Secretary of State Tillerson, the National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, General Kelly, the new chief of staff, I'm told by my sources around the president that they're trying to de-escalate the situation by working with regional partners, talking to Chinese representatives, allies in Japan, international leaders about how to handle this threat. But they do want to make sure that Kim Jong-un gets a strong message.
Let me play for you Tillerson talking on his return trip from the Philippines. Cut number 12.
The international community with respect to North Korea has actually had a pretty good week. We had a unanimous U.N. Security Council resolution to strengthen sanctions against North Korea with China and Russia joining us in that vote. And then at ASEAN, there were a lot of strong statements coming out of ASEAN that I think also reinforced that the global community has expressed its view that North Korea really needs to stand down this program. So I think in response to that, the North Koreans' rhetoric has just ratcheted up louder and louder and more threatening. So I think the president, what the president is doing is sending a strong message to North Korea in language that Kim Jong-un would understand, because he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language.
After that, Robert Costa, Lindsey Graham, no friend of the president, no fan of the president, went on CBS and said this, cut number 13.
You heard what your good friend Senator McCain said, that great leaders do not threaten unless they're prepared to act. Do you believe the United States is prepared to act?
Oh, absolutely. President Trump has basically drawn a red line saying that he'll never allow North Korea to have an ICBM missile that can hit America with a nuclear weapon on top. He's not going to let that happen. He's not going to contain the threat. He's going to stop the threat.
Now, what do you make of that, Robert Costa?
I think this is an important point, Hugh, because the hawks in the Republican Party, like Senator Graham, are not all with Senator McCain in questioning President Trump. There seems to be a real appetite in parts of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party to confront Kim Jong-un to stop this lingering threat. Of course, no one wants nuclear war. But at the same time, as much as they keep developing all these nuclear weapons, or at least the capabilities to transport a nuclear weapon, there are many voices in the Congress who I'm connected to, talking to, who want to do some kind of action.
You know, John McCain's simply wrong. I respect the senator. I wish him well, but he's simply wrong about the language. Eisenhower told the Soviet Union that if they ever threatened or attacked one of our allies, they would be destroyed as surely as night follows day or day follows night. I can't remember the exact quote. So this kind of language is actually not unusual, but the coverage of it, seeming to blame Trump for this crisis escalation, is to me nuts. The guy who has escalated this with 16 missile tests this year, and as attributed by Joe Dunford at Aspen, by General McMaster, and my wide-ranging interview with him, by the Army Chief of Staff Milley, they're all not blaming Trump. I don't get the media's fascination with trying to make Trump the bad guy here, Robert Costa. He's not. It's Kim Jong-un.
Well, it seems like Hugh, the president, responded on Twitter to this kind of observation from elements of the press and from his critics. He said in a new tweet, "Hopefully, we'll never have to use this power." Speaking of nuclear power, but there will never be a time that we are not the most powerful nation in the world. So you see the White House this morning, the president himself reacting to this view that he himself ratcheted up the stakes. And Hugh, he did use tough rhetoric. I mean, fire and fury.
Yes, he did.
Certainly calls to mind nuclear annihilation.
Sam Malone, my colleague from AM 1070, The Answer in Houston, was sitting in for Mike Gallagher this week. He turned to Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis for a look at how this threat is viewed from inside the Pentagon.
What did you think of the president's responses? Senator McCain said he shouldn't be talking like that, and liberals, of course, flipped out. What's the feeling inside the Pentagon, sir?
Well, we certainly need to be careful about sending messages. You know, I think the background to this is probably just as interesting, Sam, and that is who leaked this and what was the purpose of the leak? Clearly, a classified document, allegedly from the Defense Intelligence Agency, saying that the North Koreans have miniaturized a nuclear weapon which they can put atop a ballistic missile and then target the United States. That's pretty serious. So somebody had to have leaked it. Now, was it the U.S. and was it the Trump administration for the purpose of being able to say a message, a hard message toward Kim Jong-un in North Korea? or was it an adversary that perhaps got the information? The outcome caused quite a stir. Are they a threat? Yes, they are a threat. What is our response? Well, that has not been clear. What is clear is that Secretary Tillerson, who's been in Manila the last couple of days, continues to try to pursue a diplomatic course, and that is, we're willing to talk. So this could be good cop, bad cop. You know, the president's being the bad cop saying, look, you're under the gun. Tillerson's kind of sitting back saying, well, we do want to talk to you, but it seems to me at the end of the day, the real solution has to come from China. And China created this rogue, and China has to resolve it.
Talk to me about the upsides and downsides, Lieutenant Colonel, sir, if you can hear me, about dealing with a completely inexperienced nutbag leader of a third world country like North Korea.
Well, the upside is that I don't believe, Sam, he's irrational. You know, he just wants to preserve his own neck and his regime, which, you know, goes back to his grandfather. And he sees that the conventional weapons that he's had poised against the South and the United States no longer have the deterrent effect that he wants. And he believes, you know, having watched Gaddafi fall, having watched Saddam fall, and the way in which we've dealt with some of the other rogues in the world, that his only alternative was to develop a nuclear capability, which he has obviously not hidden from the world. So that's his shift in strategy. Now, at this point, it appears as if the Trump administration is following a prescription that was adhered to by the Obama administration. That is diplomacy, sanctions, which interestingly, the Russians and the Chinese went along with us. And then, of course, you have to begin to build up your readiness. And we've been flying jets off the coast of North Korea. We've put more ships up there. We've increased cooperation with the South Koreans with more THAAD and Patriot over in Japan. We've done ICBM tests ourselves and THAAD tests. We've done all of that. And so that appears as if they're doing much the same. The new wrinkle here, of course, is the pretty confrontational language by President when he uses the terms fire and fury. So I think that it is a good cop, bad cop routine. We're doing all the things that the other administrations have done. And now we're waiting on China, which I think ultimately has the most to lose here, short of a nuclear exchange, that they have to step up the plate. I'm not sure they will, though.
If you missed any portion of the first segment of our show, or if you want to share it with a friend, go to townhallreview.com. While you're there, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast and never miss a show. Coming up,
newsrooms are over-concerned about diversity because they don't have it.
A look at the firing at Google when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Engineer James Damore was fired by Google for a memo he wrote questioning the mammoth company's overt and aggressive political correctness. The now former employee of Google was exploring the significant gender imbalance within Google and within the tech world generally. And while the story grew as the week progressed, it started out getting coverage mainly in the bigger newsroom. Why? I took the question to David Drucker, senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Boy, do I have a story for you. All right, so let me give you my premise. I do show prep in the morning about an hour and a half before the show starts. I do the Times of London, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. And very often you'll see North Korea sanctions in each of those four newspapers. You'll see a story right that everyone is covering. Very rarely will you find an obscure story in every one of those. But this morning, all four of them covered the story from Google about the engineer getting fired. All four of them. Google fires employee who wrote memo criticizing diversity initiatives. That is not a big story in the middle of America. That just isn't. It's a huge story in newsrooms of influencers across the globe. Why is that?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think it could be because the tech community is a very sort of, it's a big thing that we follow in all these newsrooms. I would actually say, in a way, I'm surprised it's not a big story in middle America, because one of the things that has driven angst and frustration about the Acela corridor in Washington, especially on the right, is this idea of political correctness, and that you can't challenge, the idea that, of diversity and what it means. Of course, what this gentleman wrote was the idea that maybe what the tech industry should encourage is ideological diversity and not be so focused on, you know, ethnic diversity. So I would actually think it would have an appeal or be of interest in middle America because, you know, again, at least, you know, on the right, when you look at all of the clampdown on free speech, essentially, that goes on college campuses, that's been a big story that the middle America has cared about. This is part and parcel of the same story.
Well, I have a different, slightly different take. You're an influencer. Look, we're both media elites. We have MSNBC, CNN, Washington Examiner. I write for The Post. I've got a radio show.
I plead guilty.
Here's what's going on. The super media elites, the people that we work for, are sending a signal. This will not be tolerated. What they are approving of what Google did. And it is a shot across the bow of anyone who would dare break the politically correct tone in these major organizations. I mean, you can push at the margins. You can talk like I did on Hardball last night. MSNBC loves to have me around as a conservative voice. And that's okay. But if you go at the heart of the ideology, the theology, the creed of political correctness, you will be purged like this guy was purged. I think that is it's not conscious, by the way. It's not like they had a meeting and said, let's all cover Google. They all reacted simultaneously and put it on the front page because they abhor the idea that this guy had of real diversity intellectually everywhere.
I mean, look, that's a viable theory. I can't dismiss it, and it's well-reasoned. I just tend to think that newsrooms are over-concerned about diversity because they don't have it. I mean, if you look at most newsrooms, they're not very ethnically diverse. I think the gender balance isn't bad. I mean, I've worked with and for a lot of women. But the newsrooms are constantly obsessed with the idea that they're not more ethnically diverse. Of course, nobody wants to give up their jobs.
Political correctness is the heartbeat of many college campuses these days. Salem host Michael Medved discussed the latest with Dr. Everett Piper, president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, a rare and bold voice of reason in the education hierarchy. Dr. Piper is the author of the book, Not a Daycare, The Devastating Consequences of Abandoning Truth.
The basic point that you're trying to make is, we were talking last hour about the cuddling industry. And believe it or not, there is an explosive industry of professional cuddling. And I was thinking that it almost fits together because right now our universities have become professional dens of coddling, if not cuddling, and maybe a little bit of both.
Well, they have. Indeed, they are both. It's one of the reasons I wrote this book is this. A good education is not one that makes you feel comfortable. A good education, a truly liberal, if you will, a classically liberal arts education, one that liberates you, one that helps you understand liberty, one that sets you free, one that helps you understand what's right and wrong and good and just and those things that are unjust. A good education that's grounded in the classical liberal arts, if you go all the way back to Oxford, let's say, was one to educate a free people in a free society, not one to make you feel comfortable. You know, it said, C.S. Lewis said of the great lion Aslan, Michael, that Aslan is not safe, but he's good. And if I were to paraphrase that, I would suggest this. The great lion of the liberal arts, the great lion of the academy, the great lion of the college and university, of the ivory tower, is not supposed to be safe. It's supposed to be good. And there's a huge difference between goodness and safety. I don't want you to feel safe in your self-righteousness and your sanctimony and your self-absorption. I want to challenge you as a student to grow above and beyond that. I don't want to coddle you or cuddle you. I want to confront you because I want you to be a man of character.
Dr. Piper, I know that one of the objections to this book that we are going to get and that you're going to get is this is easy for you to say. You're the president of a Christian university, Oklahoma Wesleyan. How does this apply to leading institutions that are not officially Christian in any way, not officially religious in any way? What about institutions like that? How can you then also claim that it should be the job of the university to pursue goodness?
Well, every educational model, if you want to go back to T.S. Eliot's quote, education is a search for the fit for what you think man is for. Well, do you think humanity, is for liberty and liberation and freedom and justice. I would suggest that even the secular academy would affirm that, and that they think freedom is better than slavery, and truth is better than lies, and justice is better than being unjust. Even my secular friends admit that. In fact, you know, the people that have affirmed this not a daycare message as much as anything is the secularists. I've had many people write me and say, I read your not a daycare piece. I went and looked you up on the web, and I see that you're a conservative and you're a Christian. I disagree with your politics, and I disagree with your religion. I'm an atheist. But on this matter, kudos. Good for you. It needed to be said. These secular academics, these professors, recognize that they've created a monster, and it's turning around to bite them, and that they will not have intellectual freedom at the hands of this monster. They will be subject to ideological fascism, where they must submit, they must agree, they must be one of the common group, or they will be verboten and they will be expelled. Liberty presupposes the standards that G.K. Chesterton told us. If you get rid of big laws, you don't get liberty, but rather thousands of little laws that rush in to fill the vacuum. And I think even the secular mind recognizes that if you want to have liberty, you've got to acknowledge the goodness that presupposes the definition behind liberty. Or without that, you have what people pretend that you've got value neutrality in the academy, which is garbage. You don't have value neutrality. Every professor brings an agenda to the table. We just admit what ours is. We believe ours is the pursuit of truth rather than propping up this postmodern politically correct idea of tolerance. Tolerance is an inferior virtue, Michael. Christian charity and love and the pursuit of truth is a superior virtue.
Coming up, a charity works to save lives in Haiti.
I don't think people understand that there is never a moment in the history of that country when it's not in crisis.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. Get the podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In recent years, charities have come under fire for the way they handle or the way they mishandle funds, and for good reason. Some do very little, while their leaders become wealthy. But others are very legitimate. And there are indeed a handful of amazing organizations that seek to help those struggling worldwide. One I have personally admired is Food for the Poor, where an astounding 96% of all the funds raised are spent directly on programs and services they deliver. And they deliver quite a bit. I spoke with Angel Aloma, Executive Director of Food for the Poor. Tell me a little bit about conditions in Haiti. I think the drought is in its third or fourth year now.
Absolutely. And the problem with Haiti is that immediately after a drought, when all the crops are decimated, then they'll start again and they'll have floods. Then, of course, last year they had Hurricane Matthew that went right through and totally drowned their livestock and then totally left them without any food source whatsoever. So it's always a crisis in Haiti. Like, I don't think people understand that there is never a moment in the history of that country when it's not in crisis. I mean, the children, one out of every 14 die before the age of 5 just from malnutrition and contaminated water. It's not because of an accident or because of a horrible illness. And it's really something that we can fix so easily. With $50, we can feed a child for a year and give them water for life. And that's when I say water for life, because we have taken the cost of a well, divided it by a village of 1,000. And whenever we put a well in an area, we come back. If the pump breaks, we come back and replace it. If the well runs dry, we come and dig another one. And that's why we say water for life with all certainty.
And I want people to understand why this is so important. In the aftermath of the terrible earthquake, the UN arrived, but unfortunately some of the people who came with it had cholera. And so cholera, which is a terrible, it's a disease of just dysentery. You just vomit and excrete all the body water. It's called the white disease, the white rice disease as well, until you're dead. And cholera is easily treated, but it's better to prevent it by getting the water clean. And the cholera problem remains, doesn't it, Angel?
Absolutely, because there is very little sanitation. There is no sewage system in Haiti. So basically, the poor just go to the bathroom out in the, you know, like out in the street. I mean, I've seen them when I'm driving around in the street. I have seen them where they basically just pull down their pants and stoop and then use the bathroom there. They do it in their water source also, which is why there is so much contamination and why cholera spreads so easily.
Now, Angel, just to you, how do you keep going? I find the weight of the world suffering sometimes, you know, that's what I think about in mass. It's what drives me to my knees. But you just keep going back into the heart of misery. How do you do that?
honestly, Hugh, with me, after I'm in the office for 2-3 weeks, it's energizing for me to go back and see the need, and see not only the need, but see what we have done in partnership with our donors, with your listeners, what we have done to be able to save the day. It's like a superhero complex, you know. There is a crisis, and then the donors come in, and they save the day. And that's what I want them to understand, that it's not just a matter of giving someone an extra pair of sneakers. When they give to help a child like that, they are saving lives. And what a beautiful thing to think of yourself as a lifesaver. And that's what a donation does.
Now, Angel, Haiti fatigue, I've heard from my people. Sometimes they have given 2, 3, 4 years in August to our Haiti campaign. And then they say, is anything ever going to get better in Haiti? And I tell them it's a uniquely damaged country, but there is hope. Would you expand on that?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Every time I go to Haiti, I see so much improvement. For example, every single bit of rubble has been cleared from the city. Which is, you have to understand that the big heavy-duty equipment came for the embassies and the hotels and the big commerce. Like, the poor had to do it almost by hand, and every bit of rubble is cleared. They were 1.3 million in 10 cities. Now they're less than 30 million. They have moved them out of the dangers of the city into an area which is becoming almost like a little city now for them. They're starting to have shops and commerce and work for them. And they have built roads. Like, now when you go from all the way from the north to the south, you can do that in about half the time as before, because before you were like driving in riverbeds. I have never seen Port-au-Prince cleaner than it is now. And when the hurricane Matthew last year destroyed the only bridge that allowed us to get into that area, in one day, the government built a temporary road for us to be able to get help in there. So I see a lot, and the people in Haiti, they never lose hope. The 2 days after the earthquake, Hugh, when we were driving around the city, these people, when we were driving around, we had to be careful, because when we were going home at 9 o'clock at night, they were groups of them who had lost the building of their church, recognized the fact that it was their gathering that was actually church, and would be in the middle of the road singing praises to God and thanking God that they had survived. And these are people who had lost children, who had lost parents. So their resilience and their hope is all enduring. Faith in God is amazing. And so I think they're so deserving of help.
To learn more, go to foodforthepoor.org. Coming up, Dennis Prager confronts a musician who called him a hateful bigot.
I'm not going to argue with him. I find my positions. Why don't you state your position?
I am stating. I find your position to be, you know, it surprises me because it's so 20th century.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. My friend and colleague Dennis Prager wears many hats. Occasionally, it's a conductor's hat. Or actually, he carries a conductor's baton. He is slated to conduct the Santa Monica Symphony Orchestra at the Walt Disney Concert Hall later this month. But two members of that orchestra revolted, insisting they will not play with Dennis as the maestro, and they encouraged other members to refuse to play as well. Yes, it's a musical mutiny of sorts. Both those members, not surprisingly, are professors at UCLA. One of them, Andrew Apter, agreed to come on Dennis's radio program. They had a fascinating, spirited, but polite conversation. Apter previously called Prager hateful and bigoted, specifically citing his views on gay adoption. We'll pick it up there.
I think this idea that an adoption agency, all things being equal, should give a child to a heterosexual as opposed to a homosexual couple, I think I'm not a lawyer, but I think that's discriminatory. And
of course,
I think,
it is totally discriminatory.
Yeah,
I agree. I didn't ask if it's discriminatory, if it's hateful or bigoted.
Well, it's,
what would you do if you were the head of an adoption agency, putting the law aside? You have three terrific couples, two men, two women, a man and a woman. You would flip a coin?
Well, I would have to really look closely.
They're
at
all
the
wonderful.
Cases.
I'm telling. Come
if
on.
They're all completely
yes.
equivalent?
Yes.
Well, that's a theoretical possibility, but it's a very unlikely
one. All right.
But if that were the
professor,
case,
you're avoiding the question.
Well, then,
what is the ideal? Is the ideal that a child have a mother and father?
The
or
ideal
not?
Is that a child has the best possible parents.
Right. So and but so
and I think if that the, you if can't the, you have to make the determination among those couples Which one would provide that?
So you can't accept the idea that there are three wonderful couples? I mean, there are wonderful couples. I admit that there are wonderful homosexual couples. You admit that there are wonderful heterosexual couples.
I accept your premise here. So for the sake of argument, because you're making a very good abstract point here, for the sake of argument, I would say that justice is blind. I think that's what this term is.
So it's okay. So you don't think it's better, all things being equal, it's not better for a kid to be raised by a mother and father? I'm not going to argue with him. I find my positions. Why don't you state your position?
I am stating. I find your position to be, you know, it surprises me because it's so, you know, 20th century. You know, we live in a different time now.
Right. So just say, and then we'll move on. You don't think it's better, all things being equal, for a child to start out life with a mother and father?
Well, I think that you can have the role of a mother and father manifested in a gay couple.
Then, all right. Fair enough. Again, I ask you, since you now know my views, or at least the basis of some of the views, at least on the homosexuality issue, would you still say I'm a hateful bigot or just wrong?
Well, I think that some of your ideas are bigoted, and I think...
So that a child should ideally have a mother and father. Do you know that gay couples that I know and I'm very friendly and almost like a godfather to their children, they agree? There are many gays who call my show, say, of course, it's best if a child has a mother and father, but nevertheless, we do the best we can, just as... It's best if a child has a mother and father, but we all know that there were some wonderful single parents.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't say it's best to have a single mother.
You know, again, the way you're framing the alternatives as abstract principles is one thing. But if I were a child services person, I would be concerned about the best parents. And there are plenty of heterosexual parents that, including foster parents, who abuse children.
Yes,
and there are plenty of them that don't.
Okay,
and
but that's irrelevant.
No, it's not irrelevant.
You don't give them to abusers. You give them. You have to compare apples and apples. Good homosexuals and good heterosexuals. You can't compare good homosexuals to abusive heterosexuals.
But you can also compare good parents and in relation to not so good parents. And I think
you have to do good versus good. And anyway, we went through this. So I just want to know. Okay. So it's bigoted because I want this as clear as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that all things being equal, it is best for a child to start life with a mother and father. That renders me bigoted. Okay. I just want it absolutely clear for me, for my listeners.
Let's put it this way. I think most of the gay community would agree with me on this.
I'm not sure about that.
Maybe not.
I am not sure.
Let's say the jury's out on that.
By the way, it doesn't even matter. You have to do the reasonable person standard, not just the gay community.
Well, that's my point, which is the reasonable standard is more important than whether they're hetero or homosexual.
Okay.
It's the reasonable parent standard.
Right. I agree with that. And if the reasonable parents are a mother and father, it's best to start with them. Okay, next. What is my next area of why I'm a hateful bigot? Next.
Well, I don't think you as a person are a hateful bigot. I think that some of your ideas
definition. Well, but you called me a hateful bigot. Okay. What is the next area of my hateful bigotry?
Well, I think that it's one of the comments you made, which got you into some trouble with former Mayor Ed Koch. In New York, when you opposed the swearing in of Keith Ellison on the Quran, and I quote you here, because the act undermines American civilization. Insofar as a member of Congress taking an oath to serve America is concerned, America is interested in only one book, the Bible. And that's religious intolerance.
It was the first time in American history that a religious substitute for the Bible was used. Four presidents had not used the Bible because of circumstances like McKinley's assassination. There was no Bible available for Teddy Roosevelt and so on. But no one had ever substituted a text. And I wrote in my piece, which you didn't read, you only read these quotes. I wrote, if Mormons, whom I adore, if somebody substituted the Book of Mormon, I would have been opposed to it. I even said Jews should, and I'm a religious Jew. I believe the Torah is divine. That's how religious I am. And yet I would take the oath on the Bible that every other president, if I were president, which included the New Testament, because I honor the United States and its founding principles, which are Judeo-Christian. So that makes me a hateful bigot. Next, what's the next one?
Well, just to clarify, you said that the act undermines American civil liberties. Wait.
Okay.
Don't interrupt me, please.
No, I won't. You're okay.
You're like Chris Matthews on Hardball here.
No, I'm not. You know I'm not, because I haven't interrupted you at all. Go ahead.
So, you know, again, I mean, it, for me, and you are right in that I didn't read the entire piece. And but that, to me, fits a definition of religious intolerance if you're not going to honor somebody's commitment to a sacred text that they feel is sacred. I mean, England allows its swearing in on the Bible.
But
I hear you now. I hear your point.
Right. And I said within a day, well, he should do what other Muslims who have sworn in, like to ambassadors are sworn in, use the Bible and the Quran. That is what had always been done. That was my, and he refused. And by the way, he and I spoke in Congress, and he told me his mother's a big listener to the show. So I want to say hi to Keith Ellison's mom in Detroit. Mm-hmm.
To hear this conversation in its entirety, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Political cuddling? Is that a thing now?
Michael Medved in the final segment of the Town Hall Review. After this. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Some trends are stranger than others, and we live in an era of some of the most bizarre. The coddling of the next generation is leading to a world that feels more and more like a futuristic Woody Allen movie. Here's Michael Medved.
This is the big piece in Rolling Stone magazine about how cuddling is the only way to cope with the Trump era. The piece in Rolling Stone magazine, it's by Ali Volpe. The piece says, as executive orders, cabinet appointments, abuse of power, protests, and other signs of political unrest sweep the nation, there's a sense of unease brewing in many. They are turning to alternative forms of care to alleviate these fears. Marsha Basinski, who is co-founder of Cuddle Party, has seen her already established clientele reacting to the election. Many of them, she says, feel triggered by Trump's actions. His history of sexual abuse and manipulative behaviors. Marsha Basinski, the co-founder of Cuddle Party, tells Rolling Stone magazine, our work is actually political now. Political cuddling? Is that a thing now? She says it used to be that you talked about cuddle parties because these are important skills for life. Everybody's navigating boundaries. She continues, and now we need to have boundaries with our government. How the F do you do that? How do you conceptualize having a leader who is essentially an abusive beep? A significant... I'm sorry, this article continues. A significant number of those seeking professional cuddling services have experienced past abuse, and some see in Trump qualities that remind them of their past trauma. Three days after the election, Anastasia Allington, a professional cuddler in Austin, Texas, had a session with a client who was bereft and frequently broke into tears. Honestly, every single day I get emails that complain about my calling this the greatest country on God's green earth. If really there are thousands and thousands of professional cuddlers out there who are experiencing anxiety they can't handle any other way, I don't know, maybe some of the emailers have a point.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on old episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site and subscribe to our Apple Podcast or via Stitcher or SoundCloud or Google Play. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, Derek Fowler, David Posian, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.